Margaret Fuller was a force of nature. Born in 1810, her father gave her a rigorous education fit for a boy. The trailblazing feminist was also a journalist and a favorite of Ralph Waldo Emerson, who made her editor of The Dial, then the voice of New England transcendentalism. Margaret Fuller could also be opinionated and was scorned for her unconventional manners. She may be better known for her awful death than for her powerful intellect. She drowned with her Italian lover and infant son in a shipwreck pitifully close to Fire Island. April Bernard reimagines that watery grave in Miss Fuller, a new historical novel about the largely forgotten woman who proposed to open young ladies' eyes to the larger world. April is a novelist, poet, and director of creative writing at Skidmore College and here in the studio. Thanks so much for joining us, April.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we hear a lot about Emerson and Thoreau and the Transcendentalists. Not so much about Margaret Fuller. Why do you think?
Well, that's the question that was animating me when I decided to write this book. I think that, like a lot of, it's not exclusively the fate of women, it's happened to some men too. But like a lot of strong and difficult people, she did a lot during her lifetime, and then after her death, there was a kind of a campaign to make her go away. It happened to Mary Wollstonecraft, very notably. It's happened to a number of major figures. When she died in 1850, she was widely said to be the most famous woman in the world. And given that fact, that so many people I speak to have never even heard of Margaret Fuller, continues to amaze me.
We first meet Fuller as the speaker at what they call conversations. What were these gatherings?
This was a way she had of making money. It was a form of salon/lecture series that Fuller hosted, more or less, in Boston. It was designed to be a kind of informal gathering for women to develop an education. Part of what she was most interested in was access for women to education and to the professions. And she spoke eloquently, everyone said so, about almost everything. And she herself had a huge education and was disseminating it.
She's described through the eyes in the book of this fictional character of Anne Thoreau. Now, why did you invent this younger adopted sister, in fact,
yes,
to John and Henry and Cissy Thoreau?
Well, one of the reasons was when I tried using one of the actual Thoreau sisters, they were too alive and too difficult and had their own lives to lead, and they wouldn't do what I wanted them to do. I wanted very much to have what I thought of as an informed and sensitive, but essentially ordinary woman looking at this extraordinary woman. So I invented this youngest sister in the Thoreau family, who's both an insider and an outsider.
I love Anne's first vision of her. She's a largest woman in shiny magenta with a bust not fully subdued by her corsets. And, you know, the sense of this woman not being pinned down, I think her arms are gesturing as if against the wind. There's kind of just too much woman to her.
There certainly was.
So what does this mean to Anne? What's this image mean?
I think she's frightening. I think she's both a powerful intellect and a powerful sexual presence, which many, many people noticed at the time. And for my character, Anne, she's both attractive and compelling and also very, very frightening because she seems to be scary.
Mm-hmm. Could you read a bit from the book? This is
sure.
I'm thinking of is after the Thoreau family receives the news that Margaret Fuller and her son and supposed husband, a count, an Italian count, have died. Can you set that up for
sure.
us?
Sure. When Margaret Fuller was coming back to the United States with her husband, who was a count, and he had been a fighter in the Italian Revolution, they and their young son were shipwrecked off Fire Island. And the news of the deaths came up to Concord, where her old friends were. And Ralph Waldo Emerson more or less deputized Henry David Thoreau to go down to Fire Island to see if he could find her book manuscript, her History of the Italian Revolution. That was never discovered. And that was, in fact, more or less the impetus for me to write the whole book, because I wanted him to discover something else, which he does in my novel. What I have here, this is a passage where Anne, the young sister, has dropped Henry off at the train station, and she's pondering the excitement of the last 24 hours when the news of Fuller's death had arrived in Concord. And this is what she's thinking about. But there was another feeling that nudged her. Not fear, not sadness, something else. Amongst them all at the news of the wreck, there had been an unspoken, shadowy satisfaction. She could name it now and touch it. It was like a thick rope you could grasp in the dark. It was the feeling that this had served her right. Not like the other deaths in the last few years. First, the horror of their brother John, seized with fever and lockjaw. Then the Emerson's little boy taken by fever. Then darling sister Helen, flickering and sputtering like a candle flame for many months from consumption, and finally snuffed last year. Unimaginable griefs, each one more terrible than the last, the vanished beloved cried out for in the nights. And all had died as they had lived. Blameless, blameless. Miss Fuller, on the other hand, she was not blameless, not at all. This was a death made for wincing, not weeping. It even made you angrier about the other deaths. She had no one to blame but herself. When the toddler will not stop teasing the cat, and then the cat scratches, you say to the child, "See, I told you not to." Serves you right.
Well, poet and novelist April Bernard reading from her new historical novel called Miss Fuller. It's about the largely forgotten woman who proposed to help young women see, young cultured ladies, see much more of the world. Why this smugness, this righteousness after her death, even for Anne?
Well, I think that what we need to remember about Fuller is that with the writing of her book called Woman in the 19th Century, which was translated into a dozen languages and was a bestseller around the world, she actually had made an enormous impact on the thinking and talking about women's rights and women's right for education. And I think that people like that who, and then she became this first female foreign correspondent for the New York Daily Tribune and was very opinionated and wrote extensively in the newspapers. I think that people like this who essentially set out to change the world, and in her case, do it so courageously, are difficult to like, difficult to live with, and very often get trashed after their deaths. Mm. I think that Anne comes to a different relationship with the memory and history of Fuller in the course of this novel, but I think that it's partly through seeing the unfairness with which she's treated by so many other people that this happens. So although that becomes the more or less a polemic of the book, the original impulse for me writing about it was just the sense of the tragedy of this woman's death at this particular moment in her life when she was still very young and productive, and also a kind of a wish to rescue her from the disappearance that history had placed her
It's
in.
Also a kind of rigidity among the transcendentalists, right?
Yes.
You know, that Anne says, like, well, she should be speaking here, helping, you know, African Americans escape from slavery.
The abolitionists were very touchy on the subject of women's rights. They didn't want to hear about it. They just wanted to hear about abolition. That's how a lot of politics goes, you know, although she wanted to do everything. I also think it's important to remember that the transcendentalists, although very influenced by Eastern ideas and philosophy, did come out of the Puritans, and they had a very strong idea about where women should be. And what Emerson wanted of Margaret Fuller was that she remain a virgin her whole life. That was his ideal for her, that in order for her to be the new woman, she would also need to be a virgin vessel, which is just preposterous. And it's preposterous now, and it was preposterous then. And Fuller disappointed so many people by proving herself to be sexual, by proving herself to be able to bear a child late in life, and trying to continue her life of the mind and her life of writing.
With a Catholic, no less.
With a Catholic, a Catholic Italian, just a shocking
Italian
combination.
There's
moment
where there's a consideration like, well, I suppose Italians are humans too, like the Africans. Well, at the heart of your book is this collection of letters, now making up about a third of the book.
Yes.
So you're imagining her letters.
Yes.
Back to Sophie Hawthorne, wife of the novelist Nathaniel Hawthorne, He refuses to even accept the letters written by Fuller. You know, in real life, Hawthorne did have some disdain for Margaret Fuller. He even caricatured her in literature. How did he do that?
In the Blithedale Romance. Hawthorne, I certainly don't have any trouble casting him as a bit of a villain in this novel. That doesn't mean that I don't think he's a brilliant, brilliant writer. But he was he wasn't crazy about strong women. He was very ambivalent about them. And although he had been a friend of Fuller's, along with his wife, in their early years of their marriage, I think he was jealous of her hold over his wife and his friendship, her friendship with her. And in Blithedale Romance, he caricatured her rather horribly as a character named Zenobia, who's a kind of a sort of female Svengali, who ends up drowning at the end, as Fuller did in life. But in his novel, she's a suicide.
Now, Fuller was a favorite of Thoreau, but you spend more time... of Emerson. Mm-hmm. You spend much more time seeing her through the eyes and the voice of Thoreau. Why did you make that choice?
Because I think of them as a pair. I've always been fascinated by Thoreau going to the beach to look for her, and in real life, in the real accounts, he did not find anything, but he found a button off a coat, which he kept in his pocket for the rest of his life. And that little detail, I've always been interested in Thoreau, that little detail about the two of them, and the way in which he was a man, but he stayed more or less in Concord, and she was a woman, but she traveled the big world, and that they were both more or less like children of Emerson, and that they squabbled between them for his attention. They're a great pair. They were never intimate friends, but they have a sort of interesting salt and pepper shaker quality to them when you look at them in relationship to Emerson.
What was it like slipping into his skin as opposed to Margaret Fuller's? Because you write in her voice a great deal.
I think I found it just as easy. I've been in love with Henry David Thoreau since I can remember reading. So I even named my son after him, to whom the novel is dedicated.
Oh, I wondered, because it is dedicated to Henry.
It's dedicated to a Henry. So I feel a great affinity for Thoreau's his shyness and his introversion. I think those are things that I struggle with in my life. And then I also feel this enormous affinity for Fuller's wish to break through and to be accepted and to be a powerful voice.
How did you decide where to draw from the historical record and where to deviate into fiction?
Oh, well, this hews so close to truth. Mm-hmm. This is so intensively researched. I think I would scare you if I told you how long it took me to write it. It took me 15 years.
Oh, my goodness.
It's material I've been living with for 30 years, really, since I was in college. But the central fiction is the letter that she writes while she's on board ship coming home to America. And I wanted her to be able to give voice to the private experiences that she had not given voice to in her real letters or in any of her many public documents from Europe, because that seemed the astonishing thing of a woman of 39 finally falling in love, having sex for the first time, getting married, having a baby, and running a hospital during the siege of Rome. All of that just seemed extraordinary to me, as well as continuing to write her columns for the New York newspapers.
And the America that she was returning would eventually be gripped, not by revolution,
with
but
the Civil
War.
Yes.
Her history of the Roman Republic was lost to the sea. What else was lost when we lost Margaret Fuller at such an age?
Oh, I don't know. I think we lost... I think we lost a voice that would have continued and would have grown stronger, that may have provided a surprising new model for American women. She herself admired George Sand in France. Interviewed her. And I think that George Sand was such a rule breaker and very important for women of Europe. And I think that Fuller's physical presence back in America with her husband, with her baby, with her continued work in the field of arts and letters and in reporting, and I think she could have continued to contribute a sort of a presence in America of another kind of woman.
Well, I'm with the Washington Post on this one. I think it's a beautiful novel, and I thank you so much for coming in to speak with us today.
Thank you so much.
April Bernard, she's a novelist, a poet, and director of creative writing at Skidmore College. She's also on the faculty of Bennington's MFA Writing Seminars. Now, you will find a link to her website and to some reviews of Miss Fuller, her novel, at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also find links and follow us or post your reaction and thoughts about the book on Facebook and on Twitter. And a special thanks to our intern, Emma Rudock, for helping prep this. She's a big fan of Margaret Fuller.